is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, the New South Wales Agriculture Minister has just announced a discounted electronic ID tag scheme. We'll find out what it means shortly. And it's being pushed heavily in the EU. Environmental sustainability reporting will soon be with us. Mandatory reporting, that is. How well prepared are Australian farmers?
I think Australia is in a really good position. We have got legislation, we've got innovation that is really world-leading. I think, you know, the MLA's Carbon Neutral 2030 agenda, we've got the Australian Agricultural Sustainability Framework, which is world-leading. No one else has a framework that's been developed by government, industry and farmers together. I think it's really important that farmers start simply and start by benchmarking a couple of things that are important to not only their business, but also their customers.
We'll hear more about that story shortly from Catherine Marriott, who's just been doing a Nuffield scholarship on that very issue. So we'll hear more about that shortly in about 25 minutes' time from now. You can always send us a text at the Country Hour. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. You might want to text in about this issue because the state government has today announced a discount program that will make $1 electronic identification tags available for sheep and goat farmers. EID tags for lambs and kids born in 2025 will be discounted by 76 cents per tag for eligible devices purchased between November this year and October next year, or until the funding runs out. It will ensure that the EID tags available producers for $1 will assist sheep and goat farmers as they transition to mandatory ID tags from January the 1st, 2025. New South Wales Minister for Agriculture Tara Moriarty spoke to Alex James about the announcement.
So today I'm announcing the next level in support from the New South Wales Government to our farmers in New South Wales for implementation of electronic identification for New South Wales sheep and goats. This is a really important biosecurity and traceability measure that will protect farmers, industry and the broader community. And I'm announcing today that the New South Wales Government will support farmers with a significant discount for electronic tag pricing for the first year of this program. The discount will be 76 cents per tag, which will bring the cost per tag down to $1 a tag. This is a really significant discount, and it's something that farmers have been asking me for since I've been the minister, and I'm really pleased to be able to deliver this discount for them. $1 a tag for the first year of implementation will make the process a lot easier for farmers.
So will that be from today that they'll be $1, or will it be from next year?
So the program date is from the 1st of January next year, but the tag discount will be in place from the 1st of November this year. So it'll be in place in time for producers and farmers to be able to be ready for the hard start date of 1 January. And it will be for new lambs and goats that are born in the first year of implementation, so from the 1st of November.
So I understand that alongside this, obviously, you know, there's a lot of news around this EID because there's, different dates which different mandatory settings come in. There's the 1st of January next year for sheep and goats born from that day. Then, of course, there's the full rollout, or the complete rollout almost, you could say, from 2027. But one part of this has been the price of the tags, but there's also the new equipment as well. Is there any consideration around looking at how the government can support producers with helping them buy this new equipment that'll be needed to put the tags in?
So I'm really pleased that the total package of support that we're offering industry is $41 million. So that includes the discount for the tags for farmers, but it also includes implementation of the new technology that will be needed to read the tags and to be able to make this program work. So we've been rolling out many millions of dollars in support for sale yards and for agents to be able to be prepared for the implementation of this program. And this is the next step, which is the tags for actual farmers. So $41 million in total. This means that the package of support from the New South Wales Government to New South Wales farmers is the best in the country. So this is the biggest financial package of support for EID implementation in Australia.
One of the concerns around, when I know there were big calls about this last year for the tax to go down to no more than a dollar. I know New South Wales farmers were big on that, but there was a bit of a concern around the quality of plastic of these tags, especially if you're taking the cost down. Can you guarantee that there'll be no, I guess, that there'll be still good quality for these tags, so that the tags, the EIDs, don't just come off in the middle of the paddock?
Look, we need this program to work, and so the people who will be supplying the tags will be required to make sure that they're of the right type of quality to make sure that we can implement this program successfully. Again, this matters for biosecurity. It matters for protecting our industry. And when farmers are purchasing tags, they're going to want to make sure that what they're paying for is a quality product. And I expect suppliers will meet that demand.
Okay. And so there's obviously there's a bit of discussion around the difference between generic colour versus year colour tag. So is this $1 no matter if it's year colour tag or generic colour tag?
Well, this is for the first year of implementation. So from, you know, the 1st of November to be ready for the 1st of January until the funds are exhausted for the first year. Those other issues, I'll continue to work with stakeholders just as I have up until this point. Again, we want this to work. So $41 million in support means that I've been listening very carefully to stakeholders, and I'll continue working with them on the implementation.
New South Wales Minister for Agriculture Tara Moriarty speaking there to Alex James. Well, New South Wales farmers have been pushing for the change for those discounted electronic ID tags. It was one of the main tenets of the New South Wales farmers' concerns about the scheme. Xavier Martin is the president of New South Wales Farmers. He joins me now. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, Michael.
So are you pleased by this news?
Oh, look, New South Wales Farmers thanks the Minister for this announcement today, which will see the cost of the tags reduced to our policy position of a dollar a tag for lambs and kids born in 2025.
And should the scheme go further? I mean, November to January doesn't sound like a very long time, and also till the money runs out.
Oh, look, it's actually from November this year till November 25, or until the money runs out. And you've hit one of the nails on the head, Michael, that this is maybe the first, but it must not be the last funding announcement to see this transition to what is a government-mandated scheme. And, you know, the federal minister is going to have to step up and get the appropriate funding across every state and territory. You know, we're talking a massive project here, $200 million odd a year. And so it shouldn't be a haphazard piecemeal approach, state by state or territory by territory. It's got to be a national effort if this traceability uplift is going to work.
So maybe, I mean, I guess the doors will be rushed down at businesses selling the tags on November 1, and they'll probably sell out pretty fast. And that'll if you're not fast at the beginning, you'll miss out. And there's always a risk of that.
I haven't seen the detail of just how that's been modelled, Michael, but I look forward to examining it. Obviously, they've got a 60-day lead on when the lambs and kids would start to drop for that 25 year. But look, there's a lot of detail to work through. We're just really pleased that the nine principles that New South Wales Farmers Annual Conference put down nearly 2 years ago, that with this announcement today, we're actually over halfway. We've just gone from four out of the nine being achieved to five. And so we're making progress, and we'll keep at it. And we thank the Minns government for this announcement today, for Minister Moriarty's announcement. But Minister Watt's going to have to step up very soon.
Yeah, I mean, that is the issue too. It's a national scheme, or the states are dragging the chain. I gather there's some states want to keep a scheme they've got in place. The Victorians don't want to change it too much. So there's a few roadblocks in the way.
Oh, look, there's a lack of harmonisation, and don't get me started on the dysfunction around the Victorian scheme. You haven't got enough time in the country hour. What we've got to do is make sure that the leadership we need, and this is Minister Watt, needs to lead out with the funding and the rules that harmonise this whole island, this whole nation. We thank Minister Moriarty for her leadership thus far. But it's very difficult for a state minister when you've got these competing jurisdictions and this lack of harmonisation right across the nation.
So you think the ball's now in Minister Watt's court to make sure the rules are clear for everyone?
That's right. He's got to adopt New South Wales Farmers' principles, harmonise it across the nation, and fund it.
Okay. And so what do you see as the main stumbling blocks for him then? Is it just getting everyone on board and signing up to the same sort of scheme? I mean, obviously, it's important for biosecurity reasons.
Oh, and Minister Watt's great at announcing that, but he's like an interested observer from then on. He's not actually leading or putting the funds on the table. He's been throwing a few breadcrumbs. But we're talking about a $1 billion rollout here, $200 million a year. And that's going to need, if it's such a good idea for our nation to invest in this, well, the Minister Watt better start announcing the funding to underwrite it. And in the meantime, we're getting a start with the approval of the announcement today by Minister Moriarty, and that's, we're very thankful for that. But we've still got the rest of our principles to pursue.
And an in-principle support for the scheme, but you'd need more to push it over the line further.
Oh, look, all our 9 principles work together to give a proper traceability scheme. And there's going to have to be transition arrangements too, Michael, like, director slaughter for property of birth, sheep and goats, that's got to be in place because we're not going to get a tag in every year from day one.
Mm. Appreciate your time, and obviously there's some more water to go under the bridge. Xavier Martin from New South Wales Farmers, thanks for that.
Thanks, Michael.
It's 16 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
New South Wales transport operators say truck repair costs are growing as a result of the ongoing flood damage to the roads for the last 3 years. Consistent rainfall and flooding has left many rural roads in dire need of repair. As Lara Webster reports, maintenance costs are rising for those behind the wheel.
Whether it's a chronic or an acute effect on roads varies, but the reality is they're falling apart. And they're in shocking condition in places. And it used to be the case that the saying was that trucks wreck roads, but now it's the roads wrecking the trucks and restricting them in terms of their access. So a major problem that's only getting worse with every rainfall event.
That's President of the New South Wales Farmers Association, Xavier Martin. As those calls on state and federal governments to put more funding towards flood-damaged roads continue, those in the cabs say truck repair costs are growing. Stephen McDonald is the director of McDonald Brothers Transport based out of Tamworth. He says the costs are climbing.
The workshop that we operate there out of our yard, we do a bit of outside work there through it as well, and it's, it is not just our vehicles, others that come through, and you kind of look at something that's broken, you wonder how that could be possible, but it's just the continuous beating that they get, particularly. Yeah, if you are off the main roads there at the moment, it's pretty unforgiving, some of them.
By how much, even if you can give a broad figure, do you have to increase what you're charging customers?
Oh, look, it is hard to could probably put a dollar figure on it because it is consistent, the repairs and maintenance, but you'll go through a period where, something you might be quite factoring in yet, shock absorbers, etc., or repairs to suspension that should last a bit longer, so it's just a just an ongoing effect. And some months your repair bills are definitely higher than others, or what you might be expecting.
Steve McDonald, we've certainly heard from New South Wales farmers multiple times making calls for more funding from state and federal government for rural and regional roads post all of the flooding and rain we've seen in recent years. What more would you like to see from a transport and freight point of view? What more do you need?
Definitely more funding would help, but there's always a bit of roadworks going on somewhere. It's just the road network these days is that large and carries a lot of vehicles. It is a hard issue to resolve. I believe that it's a, and as I said, particularly those few wet years made it a lot worse. But the other thing is that we see a lot of, you'll see a road get repaired and then not too long afterwards it's back to, very poor condition again. I'm not too sure if something will be done that see if it can last longer, but that all comes down to the conditions, I suppose.
Mr McDonald says it isn't just an issue for New South Wales roads. and he doesn't think it's an easy fix.
Oh, I know, just talking to, he talked to other operators, you know, all over the state, up in Queensland. I was up in Queensland this time last week, and yeah, they're suffering the same issues, well and truly. It's a very widespread problem, unfortunately, and there won't be any quick fix, that's for sure.
Director of Tamworth's McDonald Brothers Transport, Stephen McDonald, ending that report from Lara Webster. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. Still on that road issue, well, to get a bit of an update on the road situation and what the state government is doing to deal with it, Minister Jenny Aitchison says there is, as we just heard there from the trucker, there is no easy fix. She's been travelling around the state and talking to many councils. She says there is money available, but there are a few roadblocks in the way, as she explains.
Yeah, so the scale of the wet weather that we've had over the last four or so years has been pretty incredible, and particularly given the drought and bushfire conditions that preceded it, because you find then that the vegetation dies back, and then when the first lot of floodwater comes through, it rips it out and we end up with huge scours. In fact, yesterday I was travelling on the road between Armidale and Kempsey, which has been a really difficult road from that perspective, and you could just see the damage that's caused to the road, both on the upslope, overhanging the road, and then also underneath it on the downslope. So that has been the real challenge. When we were elected to government, we made a commitment that we would put $390 million out into regional councils. So the 95 regional councils received that money. We were going to do it over 2 years, but given the scale of the problem and the need for urgent work, we actually put it all out in last year's budget. So councils have got that money now. The other thing we've been doing is really pushing in on that disaster relief funding money that comes through from the state and federal government to ensure that councils are getting the support they need to spend it and to get the work done.
So the councils have the money, but in a lot of cases there's been logistical time, staffing, contractor issues to actually get the work started.
Well, it's also a case that actually some of them don't have the money yet, and the reason for that being that the requirements under the federal disaster arrangements is that they need to get very detailed evidence when they do a restoration of an essential public asset restoration, and that means that they have to have proof, because that money is for restoring assets like roads and essential public assets to their pre-storm condition or pre-flood condition, and so they have to have evidence.
Not really upgrading it too much.
No, and so we've been trying to really help do that work, but as you say, the workforce it's just been really stretched because of the amount of work that's been required to restore these roads. And also, I think, we're in a situation where we're now experiencing in New South Wales the scale of floods that has been in, Queensland for many years, and we have recurrent flooding year on year on year, and it makes it quite difficult to recover from. We're working with Queensland to lean on their expertise, I guess, from the transport perspective to assist councils better. That resulted just a month or so ago with the signing of tripartite agreements with a number of the councils who'd been really badly affected. That enables them to unlock that money earlier to get the work happening. And the other thing we've been able to do is sign off on the betterment project. So that's the Build Back Better. There's $312 million that was promised by the former government in conjunction with the state and federal government. We've actually got those projects now underway, and that's proceeding as well.
Okay, so with the conditions to just sort of patch them up or get them back to where they were before the roads, is the federal government being too strict on the conditions there?
Look, I think it's just really been, everyone has been overwhelmed at once. If we look back to that period of, 2021, 22, we had recurrent flood events on top of flood events. So before damage could even be repaired, it was actually being damaged again. So getting that evidence, I know, for instance, in my area in Maitland, we missed out on one of the flood declarations. So it has been very complicated. But what we're trying to do is work with all of the councils. I'm reaching out to as many of them as I can possibly get to. We were down in the Megalong Valley just last week, we were able to restore access to the Megalong Valley after their landslide. With working with Blue Mountains Council, it's their road. They did the majority of the work, but we had transport in there giving them that support so that they had the technical expertise to really complete the work. That's got the road back to a 7.5 to 8 ton road in less than 2 weeks, which is incredible when you saw the damage. But I guess it also underlies this messaging that we have during these flood events of not driving through floodwaters, because it's not just the danger, which is the most important thing for people when they're driving through floodwaters, but putting vehicles on those roads when they are in a really wet, saturated condition creates so much more damage. It really delays the recovery process because it's more damage that we have to repair rather than just water on the road.
Minister for Roads, Jenny Aitchison there, and got a text from someone who's texting saying that he thinks it's a load of baloney because he's seen some new roads that have grooves put in by the massive trucks. In no time, he says, you can feel the bumps and you can see where the trailers are pushing the bitumen out at the edges. This person's view is that the modern trucks are just too heavy for the bitumen roads. So that's just a few of the texts coming through. A few about the sheep tags as well. We'll get to them shortly on the program. It's coming up to 26 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Researchers at Charles Sturt University, as we've heard on the program, are in the process of converting hair and hopefully low-value wool into graphite for use in lithium batteries. The program's being watched closely by wool industry types to see if it's commercially viable as an operation that might create a new tech industry here in Australia to store renewable energy. Jo Hall is the CEO of Wool Producers, and she says any extra demand for any types of wool will be welcomed by growers.
Oh, look, I think any new use for wool would be welcomed by wool growers and the industry as a whole. We're currently experiencing pretty depressed prices for particularly that low-value wool and have done for a number of years. So any type of new market or new end use could only be seen as a good thing.
So even if the value, you know, still wasn't very high, at least you'd be selling it, wouldn't you? That'd sort of put an additional buyer in the market.
Well, exactly. And I mean, maybe graphite isn't high value at the moment, but given it's graphite's use in lithium batteries, who knows what that market might do. I was reading something where between 2022 and 2028, the value of graphite is expected to increase by 53%. So, you know, with the energy sources being like changing towards that lithium type batteries, graphite could be a money earner, and if wool has a part to play on that, that's a great thing.
And I guess the other thing is moving into that sort of renewable space, a high tech space for wool. That you know, that's got to be good in terms of the sort of psyche of farmers.
Definitely, I mean, wool is, we call it the world's most sustainable fibre. I think when that phrase was coined, perhaps we weren't thinking that it could be used in lithium batteries, but you know, it does add to that narrative that it's a clean, green, renewable product. And if that's the reputation that wool has going forward, which is complementary to the luxury fibre market, that's great.
And I guess the other thing is it's better to be using wool or hair to create graphite than to be mining it overseas and shipping it back here.
Well, exactly. The demand for that should just sell itself. Again, if this is all about renewables and saving our planet, well, growing wool from sheep, which, you know, we harvest every year in fairly natural conditions, is much more palatable, I think, to the general public than mining.
And I guess the other thing is creating a new market here in Australia that might burgeon to another export market of batteries.
Well, exactly. And again, I'm not sure that's been at the forefront of growers' minds, but we will take any market that is presented to us. And again, I guess I put the caveat on it that this is fairly recent research and there's, I guess, quite a few hurdles to jump through to see this on a commercial scale, but it's a great start and quite exciting.
Jo Hall is the CEO of Wool Producers Australia, talking about that possible move of wool being turned into graphite, some of the low-value wool being turned into graphite. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 12:30. Shortly we'll have some weather details. Bit of rain around the place. We'll find out how long it's going to last, what areas are likely to get some. It seems to be a bit more than was forecast coming, so we'll find out just what's happening on the chart. A bit of a blocking motion from a system in the Tasman Sea, I think, is what's happening, according to what I've been reading on the web. So we'll find out about that shortly. But first, let's find out what's happening in the news. Adam Storey's here. Good afternoon.
Hi, Michael. Big announcement from National Cabinet this morning with $925 million to be included in the federal budget, which is 2 weeks away. It will provide a new payment for people trying to flee violent relationships. The Prime Minister says those eligible will be able to access $5,000 in financial support, along with referral services, risk assessments and safety planning. There's also been an announcement on plans to trial age verification technology in an attempt to block children blocking access to violent and pornographic content. And there's also going to be a new law to tackle deepfake sexualised content. And on top of that, the police commissioner, Karen Webb, says she is considering the use of electronic monitoring for those on bail for alleged domestic violence offences. And that came call after the death of 28-year-old Molly Ticehurst and her former partner Daniel Billings being charged with murder while he was already on bail. The Transport Minister says administrators for Bonza Airlines are hopeful they can get the company's planes flying again. It went into administration yesterday afternoon with flights cancelled across the country and leaving thousands of passengers stranded. Qantas and Virgin and Jetstar have been helping those people get home. Meanwhile, Qantas is investigating reports of customers having access to other passengers' information on their app. A statement issued this morning said the airline says it will provide more information as soon as possible, but the scale of the issue is yet to be confirmed. One passenger says they can see another customer's name on their app as well as their boarding pass for a flight.
Free flights.
I hope they get that sorted.
Away we go.
Yeah, that's it. Hawaii sounds nice.
That's right.
Overseas, and police in New York have entered the campus of Columbia University, which is the centre of the nationwide protests over the war in Gaza. The university had warned students to dismantle the tents they'd set up on lawns as part of the demonstration or face being suspended. Protesters refused to leave. Some barricaded themselves inside part of the university buildings. Dozens of officers in riot gear have now entered the campus and they're making their way into the building that was occupied, and that's an actually ongoing operation. And a bit of sport news. Jason Demetriou is no longer the coach of Souths.
Not really a surprise.
With them sitting on the bottom of the ladder.
Yeah.
And in cricket, Steve Smith's been left out of the T20 squad for the West Indies and the USA, along with Jake Fraser-McGurk. And that was despite Fraser-McGurk scoring three half centuries in the Indian Premier League. And it's the first time in more than a decade that Smith's has been overlooked for an Australian squad.
Yeah.
The selectors are saying that's a very certain, you know, different form of the game. Yeah, so we're going for experience, even though McGurk seems to be on fire.
Did he get 50 in 18 balls or something?
Just getting a text there from the...
from Steve Smith.
Jason or Steve, I don't know. Interesting choices there.
So they're sort of saying he'd still be there for the tests, but at the moment T20 is not his forte.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, well, okay. Well, let's hope we've got... Travis Head making some runs.
Yes, well, we've got Mitch Marchers, the captain, Ashton Agar, the spinners going, all around to Cameron Green and Nathan Ellis for the bowling.
Right, yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see how they go.
See.
All right.
It's been an interesting tournament, actually.
Yeah, it will be, actually. It's always a bit of fun.
Yeah.
Hip and giggle.
Yeah. Smack it. Don't take it too seriously.
Try and smack it over.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, thanks for that. All right. Thanks for that, Adam. Adam will be back at 1 o'clock. It's coming up to 25 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country. And now there has been a bit of rain around. Chris Webb's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
G'day, Michael. How are you going?
Good. So, we've seen, I think yesterday, you know, we're talking sort of 10 to 20 millimetres, but I see that probably a bit more than that around the place now, a bit more rain around the place than that in the last sort of event in the last 24 hours or so.
Yeah, associated with that front as it moved through. It's still moving along the north coast now. But, yeah, a lot of the rain fell in the Hunter coast, and around the southern mid-north coast as well, and Barrington Tops area. And there was pretty widespread 36 millimetres in that little nook. But, yeah, over the remainder of the state, falls were generally much lighter. Like, some spot locations about the western slopes of the ranges had about 15 millimetres in them. And I think that was with some thunderstorms about yesterday, really isolated, though. The showers continue for the Hunter this morning, although they're starting to ease now and move a little bit further north along the coast. I see 26 millimetres at Bungwahl near Seal Rocks, 3 hours since 9 a.m. And, less rainfall about the inland today, just isolated showers expected for the western slopes of the northern and central ranges, or there are one or two out there right now on the radar, and also in the far northwest of the state. It could be a thunderstorm in the far northwest. The only other thing of note is that temperatures pretty chilly on the southern ranges, -3 at Cooma this morning, -7 at Parish Valley, and for the next several mornings some frost patches down that way, about the far southern ranges and western slopes expected. But yeah, that high that you mentioned is actually well south of the Bight in the far southern ocean, south of the continent, and it's going to block things, block fronts moving through. So the pattern is going to remain fairly unchanged for quite a few days with a southeasterly stream. The wild card, though, is that with these blocking highs, cold air can break off and move north of there and cause, lows to develop. So we have that sort of thing taking place over the next few days. So for tomorrow, an upper level low should reach into the far northwest of New South Wales, and we should see a few showers and thunderstorms increase there. Otherwise, we'll still have the coastal showers persisting, heavier in the north. But then the low should really have some effect over, say, the northwestern third of the state on Friday, and we're looking at showers becoming widespread or tending to rain areas and local thunderstorms. And so we're looking at falls of pretty widespread, 15 to 30 millimetres, and locally up to 50 millimetres. And showers should continue coast and ranges in the onshore stream. So that's Friday. Then by the weekend, the upper low is expected just to move gradually eastward into the northeast of the state. So we're going to have an increasing trend about sort of the northeast, northwest slopes and plains, central ranges, central west slopes and plains on Saturday, as well as coastal parts. So the whole lot will just be turning to rain areas by the look of the European Centre Model Guidance,
right,
which is consistent with, this is the sort of thing that can happen in this kind of pattern, tapping into the moisture coming down through Queensland. So it looks like quite a lot of rain across the weekend. The rain should contract to become a bit more coastal on Sunday as the upper low weakens over the northeast of the state. But yeah, Sunday looks as though it'll be pretty wet for central and northern parts of the coast, and with a coastal trough and the possibility of a small-scale, relatively weak low, or lows embedded in that trough.
So you talk about the northwestern sort of third of the state. So we're talking Bourke, Ningen, maybe Dubbo, getting that sort of 15, 20 millimetres. Well, what areas?
On the Friday? Yeah, okay. Yep. No, it's sort of a little bit further to the northwest, I think, on the Friday. Yeah, Bourke and Broken Hill.
Right.
Way out that way, just reaching into Cobar later. That's on Friday. On Saturday, more about the northern tablelands, northwest slopes and plains, so and down to the central west slopes and plains and central ranges as well. So once again, sort of Bourke, Brewarrina, out to Moree, Walgett, even reaching as far east as Armidale area.
What about the central west? Because I know some people there, and also the Western Riverina like to see a bit of rain. Are they going to get much?
Okay. The central west, yes, I think. It's probably looking like it's on the edge of where the guidance has the heavier rainfall, but like central west should see, I would say, 15 to 20 millimetres, something like that on Saturday is a 24-hour total. And you know, in northern parts of the Central West Slopes and Plains more. But yeah, the Riverina, like down in the south, particularly the Riverina and South West Slopes, looks like it misses out on, at this stage, the guidance is suggesting the heavier rain is north of there. So yeah, it doesn't look like a great deal gets to that far southern inland. It's more northern and central inland parts.
And you've been talking about that system, that high sort of blocking things, and is that going to sort of keep some rain on the coast for a while, for a number of days? Yeah. I've heard some reporting of that.
Yeah, that's the idea. So we're looking at pretty widespread for central and northern parts of the coast, 30 to 50 millimetres, locally 100 for Sunday. And the reality is Monday and Tuesday, the falls could be quite similar. With the slow movement of that high-pressure system maintaining an onshore stream, where it looked like widespread showers, heavy at times for Monday and Tuesday. But, yeah, at this stage, it doesn't look like the models are not suggesting an east coast low. We have to watch this space, I suppose.
Mm.
But, yeah, it looks like it'll be not the really heavy dump, but, yeah, the persistent and just briefly heavy showers coming onshore for the early part of the new week.
And
piling up over time, over a couple of days.
So 50 or 100 millimetres, not out of the question over a couple of days. Yeah. And what about over the divide, like into the New England, or the Hunter Valley is going to get a bit of rain, I gather, but the New England or further west of that, you know, say Gunnedah, Tamworth?
Yeah, I think, definitely for Saturday, that looks like a great drop of rain down through there.
Yep.
Like I said, 20 to 30 millimetres locally, 50 for that western slopes of the northern ranges. But yeah, by Sunday and into Monday and Tuesday, I don't think there'll be much spilling over the divide. It'll be more associated with an onshore stream, so keeping it to the east of the main range. But computers, it's a long way out, it's a week away, but they're suggesting there could be another upper trough come through sort of over the top of this high. So yeah, it's possible there'll be some more inland rain middle of next week. Watch this space, I suppose.
Okay, and what about the southeast, like Bega and, you know, and the Monero? Are they going to get much out of this too?
At this stage, it looks like just further north of there.
Right.
Like at this stage, it just looks like there'll be a few showers around to that part of the world each day over the, there are some showers down that way now. But yeah, it looks like it's just showers down there rather than the heavier totals, the heavier showers. But yeah, sometimes, as you know, Michael, we're following the models, these things do change, particularly out several days. But yeah, that's how it looks. There's going to be some rain around. So yeah, just the details of where is a little bit tricky.
All right, Chris, thanks for that.
No worries.
See ya. It's coming up to 18 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, the local Land Services Natural Capital Conversations Conference is underway in Wagga today, and land managers and advisors have heard that the move towards sustainability reporting is coming and we need to prepare. It's something that promoted keynote speaker and Nuffield scholar Catherine Marriott to visit some key export markets and agricultural competitors. She told Emily Doak that mandatory reporting is coming and it's time to find out what's happening in our markets.
So I went to Australia's largest trading nations. I started in the EU because the ESG conversation really has largely been driven by them. I went on a contemporary scholars conference, which was extraordinary because all the scholars from around the world met in Brazil for a couple of weeks and learned about the Brazilian agricultural system. From there, went to the US and then South Korea and Japan, because we trade a lot with them. So I wanted to understand what they were thinking. And what I found flipped my judgments on its head. It was really interesting.
And so in terms of like that export market access, as you say, the EU's been driving it, you know, what's the position there in terms of what's coming in terms of potential for us to be exporting our products to the EU?
So the EU is a relatively small market for Australia, except for canola. A lot of our wool ends up in the EU, so it's important from a wool perspective as well. But they have drivers which are largely driven around deforestation and carbon or greenhouse gas emissions. The government is pushing that pretty hard, but they're finding it hard to get things through. So they're getting a lot of pushback, and a lot of the legislation that's coming out of the EU is actually quite significantly watered down. I think the biggest pressure is actually coming from the commercial sector, because they're answerable to shareholders and investors. shareholders. And I think that becomes really complicated because you've got a juxtaposition of shareholders wanting profit, but also wanting to invest in companies that are green and not just greenwashing either, doing genuinely good things. So the EU is driving the agenda. I think to ignore the EU because, you know, politics is fickle is naive. I think that they are a good leader for us to start thinking about what's coming next and how can we proactively change or manage our business models to best prepare for what's coming.
And what about, say, something like Japan, which is an important market for, you know, our beef and that sort of thing? What's their view about ESG and particularly, I suppose, that sustainability or that environmental aspect of it?
Japan was fascinating. I think it's important to put up front that everybody cares about the environment, right? It's just to be able to put environment above social outcomes and food security is a real privilege. And what I learned in Japan is that 70% of their calories are imported. So I spoke to the government and the government had a view on and have developed a strategy called the Midori strategy, which is largely aligned with the EU, reduction in chemicals, reduction in fertilizers, etc. But when I spoke to the commercial sector in Japan, they were like, are you kidding? We need food. We need calories. We can't afford to be too fussy. So there's a bit of a conflict going on in Japan. But what my summation of Japan is I think that we'll have access to that market for a long time. And we need to be continuously working towards helping them with their environmental goals for sure. But I think, you know, my concern around that market was somewhat placated.
And what about looking at some of our, I suppose, major competitors in terms of our agricultural produce and Brazil, for example? What's the picture there that surprised you?
Oh my gosh, Brazil is like unequivocally leading global agriculture. It is extraordinary. I was really surprised by their legislation protecting the Amazon and the Cerrado region. So they, as well as actually the entire country of Brazil, so they have really strict guidelines on deforestation. So if you're farming in the Amazon, for example, you can only clear 20%. So the complexity here lies in the fact that Brazil has legal deforestation. The EU has deforestation legislation where you can't clear anything. But where that gets interesting is the EU provides 44% of the, sorry, Brazil provides 44% of the EU soy to feed their livestock. So, you know, that puts EU with a few decisions to make. Brazil as a country fascinated me. They are doing amazing things with research, innovation, seed breeding. And I think they're really, like, once the world decides how to quantify natural capital in a globally consistent way, just brace yourself. Brazil's coming.
And that's surprising because the narrative that we've heard often is clearing the rainforest to make hamburger meat.
And isn't that fascinating? It's a little lesson in leadership, isn't it? Or in actually in life, where so often we hear what people want us to hear. There's an agenda behind it. And the beautiful thing about Nuffield is you get the opportunity to go and actually look and speak to real people on the ground and find out what's really happening. It was incredible driving around there, seeing the corn and soy fields with massive swathes of rainforest in between the paddocks. And diversity, like real diversity, not just single species trees being planted.
So looking at, you know, the overall lessons of what you've learnt, you've said that the driver for this is really coming from the commercial space. So that's the consumers who are eating the product, the people who are investing in these big food producing companies wanting to both get profits, but also to be more sustainable. So, you know, where does that place Australia in this?
I think Australia is in a really good position. We have got legislation, we've got innovation that is really world leading. I think, you know, the MLA's Carbon Neutral 2030 agenda, we've got the Australian Agricultural Sustainability Framework, which is world leading. No one else has a framework that's been developed by government, industry and farmers together. I think that, you know, the urgency of data capture has been relieved somewhat, but it's still there and ignore that at your peril. I think it's really important that farmers start simply and start by benchmarking a couple of things that are important to not only their business, but also their customers. I think so often in agriculture, we don't engage with our customers enough to find out what it is that they want and what's important to them. And when I spoke to the commercial sector globally, they're interested really in greenhouse gas emissions, carbon accounting and carbon banking and natural capital. So start there. And I think Australia's in a really good position to compete globally, keeping in mind compared to countries like Brazil and America, we're a pretty small part of the international trade.
Catherine Marriott is a Nuffield scholar. She spent 10 weeks travelling through the UK, Europe, the US, Africa, Brazil, South Korea and Japan. It's 11 to 1. We're getting some texts on the sheep ID tag. Someone's texted in saying it's another white elephant, just like the cattle tags. Costly and unnecessary. Government won't be happy until farmers are extinct. Government has no idea. It sounds like a good idea, but it will be another disaster. And Joe has texted in from Mullally to say farmers are selling off sheep as there's no money to be made. They're just a lot of work. It's coming up to 10 to 1.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. National Cabinet meets for urgent talks on violence against women. Are governments doing enough? Australia's had success with public health campaigns in the past. Can some of the same techniques be used to change behaviour in domestic violence? And outback tennis. Coaches take to the road in remote New South Wales, bringing the joy of the game to local young people. Those stories and much more coming up this lunchtime on The World Today.
And on the Country Hour, we've been reporting about mobile coverage. If you're in a rural area struggling to get decent mobile coverage, a major deal between the country's second and third largest providers could be good news. This week, Optus announced a $1.6 billion network sharing deal with rival TPG, which will result in Vodafone gaining access to the Optus network, which will allow them to shut down about 500 mobile phone towers of their own. TPG, which is the parent company of Vodafone, says the agreement will allow it more than double its 4G coverage and reach 98.4% of the Australian population. Selena Green asked telecommunications expert Mark Gregory how this deal will work.
Under the deal, they will be utilising the Optus infrastructure, and Vodafone has indicated that they will retire their about 500 towers that they've got in regional remote areas. I mean, the Vodafone network is quite small in regional remote areas. So what we're essentially seeing is the second and the third largest mobile carriers combining to put their effort into growing their presence in regional remote areas. So it is going to be a positive outcome for consumers. However, it does not have regulatory approval at this point. But if you look at the ACCC's decision on the proposed agreement that was put up last year between Telstra and TPG, or Vodafone, there were several issues that the ACCC identified, and the agreement that's been put forward by Optus and Vodafone, or TPG, appears at this stage to have tackled and overcome the concerns that the ACCC has, made previously. Mm. But we will, of course, have to wait and see what Telstra says in terms of their position on the agreement, and also what the ACCC finally decides.
Yeah, so I think the last time we spoke was around when the sort of the knocker was put on the Telstra TPG deal. So this is obviously a bit different story, but Telstra might not be too thrilled about its rivals teaming up.
Oh, first thoughts would be that there would be some concern in Telstra. I mean, they really wanted the deal last year to go ahead because they would have been able to utilise the Vodafone spectrum on their network. Because we need to remember that, performance and coverage is enhanced the more spectrum that you have. And so the idea of Telstra and Vodafone teaming up would have been very beneficial for both companies, but particularly for Telstra. Now you've got the flip side where Optus is teaming up with Vodafone, and therefore it's really advantageous to Optus. But of course, it also means Vodafone customers will be able to get coverage in areas where they couldn't previously.
RMIT telecommunications expert, Associate Professor Mark Gregory. First up, casino cattle.
Good afternoon. Following last week's small yarding, numbers lifted to 1,150 head, comprising of a good supply of young cattle, mainly vealers and weaners, and a fair yarding of cows. Falls of rain in areas of the state, as well as Queensland, resulted in keener competition from restockers, lifting prices for weaner steers and heifers, with the better presented cattle making the best gains. Restocker weaner steers sold from 240 to 392 cents to average 350. Restocker weaner heifers 196 to 289. Not a lot of yearlings. The steers sold from 268 to 364 and the yearling heifers 198 to 256 cents. Grown heifers were in limited supply and topped at 255 cents. The strong cow market saw three scores sell from 188 to 202, four score cows 200 to 230, and best of the heavy bulls 253 cents. Doug Robson from Casino.
Carcor sheep and lambs.
Numbers lifted 2,200 for Yarni of 8,700 lambs. Quality improved with good runs of trade and heavy lambs, along with a small supply of extra heavies. Most of the regular buyers were present and the market sold to dearer trends. Lightweight processing lambs to 18 kilos were $5 dearer, selling between 76 and 115. Trade lambs 20 to 24 kilos were also 5 better, 134 to 178, with the heavy trades to 26 kilos up $3, 179 to 200. Heavyweight lambs over 26 kilos were up to $20 dearer. They sold from 203 to 238. Hoggets were 3 better, selling from 50 to 110. There were 1,600 mixed quality mutton yarded where prices held relatively firm across most grades. Merino ewes sold from 28 to 58, with crossbred ewes selling from 20 to 121. Weathers sold to 98 and rams to 18. This has been Angus Williams for MLA at CTLX.
Let's go to Cowra Sheep and Lambs now. Rob Pearce, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. There were 3,700 lambs up by 1,000. Quality was not to the standard of the last few weeks, with more mixed lambs throughout. And there were a few heavyweights penned. Trade and lighter lambs were well supplied. Medium and heavy trades held firm. 20 to 22 kilos, 140 to 146. 22 to 24, 150 to 169, averaging 660 cents. Heavyweights were also firm to slightly dearer in spots. 24 to 26, 164 to 174. 26 to 30, 178 to 196. 30 plus, 198 to a top of 217. Averaging 660 to 685 cents. And mutton numbers increased for 1,100. Quality was good and prices improved. Heavy first cross ewes sold from 76 to 120, averaging 300 cents. It's been Rob Pearce from MLA at Cowra.
Thanks, Rob. Let's go to Yass Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. An increase in lamb numbers of 7,215, and the quality also showed an improvement, but there were still plenty of light and two-scored trade lambs. Heavy and extra-heavy lambs were better supplied. There was an extra order buying second-cross feeder lambs, and all the usual buyers were operating in a stronger market. Two-score processing lambs were $8 dearer, 73 to 124. The trade lambs, 20 to 24 kilos, lifted $6 to $9, 131 to 168, and averaged 680 to 710. The plain of trades were around 650 cents. 24 to 26 kilos, up $6, 170 to 185. Heavy lambs, 26 to 30, lifted 10, 195 to 209. And extra heavies, 209 to a top of 225. Very heavy hoggets reached 140, mutton numbers lifted to 6,300, and the quality was very mixed. Prices were firm to 6 dearer on the light and medium weights, heavy sheep 11 to 16 stronger. Crossbreds reached 140, merinos 98, the better covered lines range between 270 and 300 cents. And this has been Graham Richard.
To Mossvale Cattle.
Good afternoon, Michael. Numbers doubled for a total yarning of 1,901 mixed quality cattle. There were some good runs of prime veelers to suit the trade, along with large numbers of plainer cattle suited the feedlot buyers or restockers. There were 400 ideal feeders and 190 cows. All the usual buyers were operating, selling to a firm to slightly softer market, influenced by the quality and quantity on offer. Prime veelers reached 370, the limited supply of trade yearlings 10 better overall, steers 285 to 330, heifers 270 to 322. Feeder steers slipped 10, 268 to 366, heifers to feed up to 20 cents dearer, 240 to 290. Young cattle returning the paddock firm to a few cents better, 298 to 394 for the steers, the heifer portion 195 to 320. Heavy grand steers reached 315 to average 245. Grand heifers 215 to 280. Two and three score cows back four, 120 to 202. Heavy four score cows firm to a few cents better, 198 to 230 cents per kilo. There's still two agents to complete their run. This is David Kent at Mossvale for MLA.
to Singleton Cattle.
Good afternoon. Gentle rain through the night and throughout the sale of 10 to 40 millimetres saw Singleton Agents Yard a much improved supply of 709 good quality cattle, a sharp rise of 423 head. The bulk of the yarding consisted of some excellent drafts of Angus, Limousin and Charolais weaners with around 75 cows offered. With all the regular buyers at the rail, along with local restocker demand, market for most grades was dearer throughout. Restocker steer weaners jumped 45 cents, 270 to 372. Over 330 kilos, 37 cents better off, 314 to 350. Restocker heifer weaners up 34, 180 to 308. Over 330 kilo, local butcher B-muscle calves made to 344. Two score cows to restock and process, 8 to 28 cents better off, 138 to 196. Pregnancy tested Angus cows back to the paddock made 224. Heavy 3 and 4 score prime cows, 22 to 26 cents dearer, 222 to a top of 240. Angus Barlow for MLA at Singleton.
You've been listening to The Country Hour. We'll talk tomorrow between 12 and 1.